From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Big business, organized labor, and House Republicans join forces to reject higher fuel efficiency standards for SUVs, permit oil exploration in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and provide billions in tax breaks for the energy industry. Today, a debate with award-winning investigative journalist Keith Bradshaw from Detroit, the Sierra Club, and the auto industry, and environmental writer Bill McKibben on writing, objectivity, and SUVs.
Don't waste gas, and so on and so forth, none of which seemed to me quite strong enough. So I drew up the sign and convinced one of his ministers to hold it up in his collar, and it just said on it, what would Jesus drive?
All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The House of Representatives passed a sweeping energy bill yesterday. After a day and a half of intensive debate, Republican leaders managed to preserve major parts of the Bush administration's energy plan while defeating the environmental movement on two major issues. In the most dramatic vote of the night, the House voted to allow oil and gas drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska, a move which environmental and other groups had lobbied fiercely to defeat. The AFL-CIO helped to pass the measure yesterday when it endorsed drilling in Anwar, saying it would create jobs. In the second important vote, the House rejected an effort to increase fuel efficiency standards in SUVs and light trucks, a measure vigorously opposed by auto manufacturers and automobile workers' unions. More on that in the rest of the show. The chocolate industry and its allies are mounting an intense lobbying campaign to fight off legislation to require slave-free labels for their products. The proposed legislation is a response to a Knight Ridder newspaper investigation that found some boys as young as 9 years old are sold or tricked into slavery to harvest coca beans in the Ivory Coast, the West African nation that supplies 43% of U.S. cocoa. The House of Representatives passed the labeling initiative in late June, and the measure awaits Senate action. The Chocolate Manufacturers Association, a trade group that represents U.S. chocolate producers, has retained two former Senate majority leaders, Bob Dole, a Republican, and George Mitchell, a Democrat, to lobby lawmakers. It also enlisted allies such as the Grocery Manufacturers of America, which represents companies such as Kraft and General Mills. Kraft is owned by Philip Morris. The Navy plans to resume the bombing of Vieques today, ignoring the results of a non-binding referendum on the Puerto Rican island. Last week, more than two-thirds of voters endorsed an immediate end to using Vieques for bombing exercises, called for immediate Navy pullout. A House committee recommended yesterday the Navy continue using the island for bombing practice until an equal or better site becomes available. It also recommended canceling a Puerto Rico-wide vote in November that could give residents a limited say on the issue. This news from Philadelphia. 10 activists arrested during last summer's Republican National Convention filed civil rights lawsuits against city authorities yesterday, accusing them of false arrest and malicious prosecution. More than 70 people were arrested at the warehouse used as puppet-making studio and staging point for scores of protesters who demonstrated at the convention that nominated George Bush for the White House last August. The Federal Environmental Protection Agency's Administrator, Christy Whitman, has agreed to go ahead with a plan issued in the closing days of the Clinton administration, requiring the General Electric Company to spend more than $500 million to dredge PCB pollution from the Hudson River. The draft order will set into motion the biggest environmental dredging plan in U.S. history. After more than two decades of disputes over the science of dredging and the political, economic, and moral issues of corporate responsibility, the order to dredge a 40-mile stretch of the Hudson north of Albany is a huge defeat for GE, which had spent tens of millions of dollars fighting the proposal. In international news, Turkish troops have forcibly emptied two Kurdish villages in southeast part of the country and have laid a food embargo on another three, as well as banning entrance and exit for their inhabitants. The measure is an apparent revenge for the death of a soldier who died after stepping on a mine. The Turkish Human Rights Association said yesterday that paramilitary gendarmes had launched operations near the five villages in the southeast province of Sinark since the beginning of June and had taken 33 locals into custody. The human rights group said that three of those who'd since been released had been tortured by various means, including electric shock, sexual assault with wooden objects, and having nails driven through their hands. 26 villagers are still being held in custody. Turkey is one of the largest recipients of U.S. military aid. German gay and lesbian couples celebrated today as a new law took effect allowing the registration of same-sex partnerships. Despite wide public support for the partnership registration, opposition conservatives tried to block the law allowing the partnerships, which was championed by the environmentalist Greens and supported in the German parliament by their allies in the governing coalition, the Social Democrats. Under the new law, lesbians and gay men who register their relationships will have the same inheritance rights as heterosexual couples, may share a surname, and their foreign partners may join them in Germany. But the law does not give same-sex couples the tax advantages granted heterosexual married couples or the right to adopt children. And about 1,000 people in Frankfurt, Germany, are camped out near the city's international airport for week-long demonstrations against the forced deportations of illegal immigrants. The demonstrations are being staged by the group No One Is Illegal, which supports open borders, eased immigration laws, and an immediate halt to deportations of illegal immigrants.
Take you riding in my car, car. Take you riding in my car, car. Take you riding in my car, car. Take you riding in my car. A horn on my car goes a beep, beep, beep. A horn on my car goes a beep, beep, beep. A horn on my car goes beep, beep, beep. Take you riding in my car now. Hey, the door on my car goes clickety-clack. Door on my car goes clickety-clack. Door on my car goes clickety-clack. Take you riding in my car, car. The trees and the houses pass, pass along. Trees and the houses, they roll along. Trees and the houses, they roll along. I'll take you riding in my car, car.
Bruce Springsteen singing Woody Guthrie's song Riding in My Car from the CD Till We Outnumber 'Em here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Handing President Bush a huge victory, the House of Representatives late yesterday rejected a proposal to boost fuel efficiency standards for SUVs and approved oil exploration in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The measures were part of a sweeping energy bill containing over $33 billion in tax breaks and incentives for the energy industry. The bill was backed by a powerful coalition of oil, gas, coal, and nuclear power industries, as well as organized labor. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, the energy sector contributed nearly $65 million to federal candidates and parties in the last year, 75% to Republicans. One of the bill's sponsors, Louisiana Republican Billy Towson, raked in nearly $200,000 in campaign contributions from the power industry. The bill's other sponsors also received large donations. A National Academy of Sciences report released earlier this week contradicted years of arguments by the auto industry. It concludes that SUVs and trucks could achieve between 25 to 50% better mileage at a cost which would be completely offset by savings on fuel. Despite this, Democrats from auto-producing states joined a majority of Republicans to preserve gas mileage standards for SUVs almost unchanged instead of raising them to the same level as cars. A full-size sport utility vehicle emits nearly 11 tons of carbon dioxide a year, an important global warming gas. That is almost twice as much as the midsize cars that have dominated the American road. In another vote yesterday, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee unanimously approved a resolution calling on President Bush to return to the bargaining table this fall with specific proposals for either revising the Kyoto Global Warming Treaty or negotiating a new binding agreement for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Today we're going to have a debate on SUVs, global warming, and the Bush Energy Plan. We'll be joined shortly by spokespeople from the Sierra Club and the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. But we're going to begin with Keith Bradshaw in Detroit, who is a New York Times reporter, won a George Polk Award for his investigative reporting on SUVs. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well, first, can you tell us why SUVs are important and singled out?
SUVs are counted as light trucks, which back at the time they wrote the fuel economy regulations in the 1970s, were a small category. Back in the 1970s, light trucks meant pickup trucks and were used mostly by farmers and small businesses, and so they were given much lower gas mileage standards. Now, since then, automakers have begun building a large numbers of minivans and sport utility vehicles, which also count as light trucks and therefore also qualify for the lower fuel economy standards. They can burn a lot more gasoline to go a mile than a car can and still meet the government standards.
But can you explain further how it is that SUVs were excluded from rules on fuel efficiency?
Well, back in the 1970s, they were trying to draw up laws that would allow businesses to remain competitive, including with foreign businesses, and they didn't want to put too many restrictions on the vehicles that they used. Some farmers and outdoorsmen used to drive sport utility vehicles. There were sport utility vehicles in the 1970s, but a lot of them were used, for example, by power utilities and railroads, which bought a lot of bare-bones Suburbans in those days and used them to carry work crews to remote rail lines or power transmission lines that needed to be fixed. And so there was a provision that said that the sport utility vehicle counted as a light truck. Now, at the time, sport utility vehicles were under 1% of the U.S. vehicle market. Now they're 20% and growing. They're about 10% of all vehicles in use on the nation's roads, so the expectation is that the proportion of vehicles on the nation's roads that are SUVs will double over the next 10 years or so.
What was your reaction to last night's vote by the House of Representatives?
I thought it was a big win for George Bush, for Republicans, and for the auto industry. What a lot of people don't appreciate is the economic importance of this industry. If you look at it, a lot of people talk about the internet, or about the computer industry. Well, GM and Ford, for example, are each 8 times the size of the Microsoft Corporation. GM and Ford are each bigger in terms of annual sales than all of the world's airlines combined. And there was a real reluctance on the part of the Congress to risk creating disruption for such a big economically important industry. So you had Democrats from states where the automakers are important voting along with Republicans not to raise these standards. There also was a vigorous discussion on the safety issues. And those have been controversial for years. The National Academy of Sciences panel, in fact, split on this question. The majority said that there was a chance of hurting safety by raising gas mileage standards because one way that automakers could make sport utility vehicles and other light trucks more fuel efficient would be to make them lighter weight. And lighter weight vehicles are somewhat more likely to roll over. And the government has repeatedly decided not to limit the extent to which vehicles roll over. Lighter weight vehicles also might not provide as much protection in collision with the very heavy vehicles that have been sold over the last 10 years.
One of the people who testified in the House debate last night was Congressmember Heather Wilson of New Mexico, Republican. She said she drives a Subaru Outback with her children sitting in the back, and she said, "I'm not willing to compromise their safety by setting an accelerated standard that's not technically possible."
A Subaru Outback is actually a pretty fuel-efficient vehicle. What really is at issue here are the full-sized sport utility vehicles and full-sized pickup trucks that really guzzle a lot of gas. It would be very hard for the automakers to continue selling large numbers of Ford Excursions or Chevrolet Suburbans or Toyota Sequoias or Ford Expeditions if the Congress were to raise the fuel economy standards. So some of those vehicles get 12 miles to the gallon in the city, 16 on the highway, and it's very hard to sell many of those and still try to raise your fuel economy, average fuel economy for all the light trucks you sell, to 27.5 miles per gallon, which is what the defeated amendment would have done.
Keith Bradshaw, you were the one who published on the front page of the New York Times a draft of the National Academy of Science study. Can you talk about its significance and what happened after you published that piece?
The draft report that the 13-member panel sent out to 9 outside reviewers for comment was a strong document, strongly worded document, saying that there were real opportunities for big increases in fuel economy. It said that it played down the safety risks. While it did have some discussion of safety risks, it said that virtually all vehicles could have their fuel economy improved substantially if the technology were improved, if more sophisticated engines were used, that it wasn't necessarily clear that automakers would improve fuel economy by making vehicles lighter weight. In the recommendation, it recommended that the government intervene to increase gradually fuel economy standards in the United States. After that story ran, environmental lobbyists and auto lobbyists alike contacted the panel, and it's not entirely clear what happened to the draft report, but somehow when the final report came out 2 weeks later, the report no longer had, for example, the sentence about saying that virtually all vehicles could be improved in fuel economy without hurting safety. It no longer recommended that average fuel economy be increased gradually. It simply said that fuel economy standards should be left to elected officials, and its warnings about safety were more dire. A person familiar with the panel's deliberations told me in an article that I wrote last week that this was a result of auto industry pressure on the panel. The auto industry denies that, and the chairman of the panel said on Monday when they came out with the report that the many changes to the draft were the result of comments from the outside reviewers and panel members simply having changed their minds, as well as typos in the draft that was sent out to the reviewers.
We're talking to Keith Bradshaw. He's the Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times and has been investigating SUVs for a long time. So you report on the draft study, and then the auto industry gets involved. And how much of the change do you attribute? How much change happened from the draft to the final version of this?
Well, I mean, the changes were considerable. What really happened was the language was toned down. It became much more cautious about how much improvements could be made. The original version just simply said, look, over the 14-year life of a vehicle, you can make these 25 to 50% improvements, and they'll pay for themselves in gasoline savings over the 14-year life of the vehicle. And there won't be that many negative safety consequences. The final version, first of all, they took these 14-year calculations out of the executive summary and buried them near the back. They added a second table saying, well, if you're only leasing the vehicle for 3 years and you don't care about the fuel economy after the first 3 years, then you're probably not going to be willing to pay for more than a small increase in fuel economy. And then they also the study also became much more cautious about safety risks to driving lighter vehicles. And instead of saying in the executive summary that take 6 to 10 years for big increases in fuel economy to be possible, it said that big increases in fuel economy would be needed to be made over the next 15 years, so giving the auto industry a lot longer. I am told that people on the panel felt pressure from the auto industry. Certainly this is a panel in which most of the members have worked for the auto industry at some point in their lives. On the other hand, the chairman of the committee was emphatic at the press conference on Monday that this was not, that the changes were not the result of outside pressure, but simply people changing their minds on their own and responding to comments from the 9 impartial reviewers.
Keith Bradshaw is Detroit bureau chief of the New York Times. When we come back, he'll be joined by a spokesperson for the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, as well as from the Sierra Club. You're listening to Democracy Now! After that, a speech by Bill McKibben, the well-known environmental writer. And he talks about objectivity, protest, and SUVs. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the extension to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, we'll talk to Professor Edward Said about the targeted killings by the Israeli military of Palestinian leaders. But today we're talking about global warming, about SUVs, and about the major energy bill that was passed by the House of Representatives last night. Big business, organized labor, and House Republicans joined forces to reject higher fuel efficiency standards for SUVs, as well as permit oil exploration in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. But we're talking about SUVs right now. I wanted to get the response to this big victory for George Bush from Greg Dana, Vice President of Environmental Affairs for the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. Can you talk about how the victory was accomplished?
Well, I'd like to think that the people in Congress carefully read the NAS report, where it talks about the fact that the NAS report is not recommending standards. It talks about technology and things that can be done. It talks about the complexity of the subject of CAFE standards and how you have to weigh impacts on safety and impacts on other attributes of vehicles against fuel economy standards. And that's best done, if it's going to be done, by regulatory agencies like NHTSA, not by the Congress.
And NHTSA is?
I'm sorry, NHTSA is the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. It's the agency of the arm of DOT that, in fact, sets the fuel economy standards. And it's worthwhile to point out that the fuel efficiency of cars and light trucks have been improving by about 2% per year consistently, and that's according to EPA. And what, unfortunately, many people in the public and some people in the media, in fact, don't understand, CAFE is a sales-based average. In other words, it depends on what consumers purchase. Okay, there's no pressure on consumers to do anything different. Consumers don't value fuel economy today, so they purchase what they perceive as they need in a vehicle, and makes it difficult for the industry to meet standards when the consumer is the deciding factor on what vehicles are purchased. But it's important to understand that we are, in fact, improving fuel efficiency of both cars and trucks by using advanced technologies. And that's why we are supporting the part of the bill that deals with tax credits for very advanced technology vehicles, things like hybrids, which are very expensive compared to a conventional car. We think with those types of technologies, the tax credits will help influence purchasers to buy them. And then eventually the volume production of those technologies will reduce the cost where it can become more mainstream. So I think we are doing a lot of the right things. Unfortunately, I think it gets misunderstood.
Kate Simmons, a conservation organizer for the Sierra Club on the Global Warming and Energy Team, your response to the Bush victory last night.
Well, clearly we're very disappointed. We think that Americans want to drive cars, go further on a gallon of gas, and especially making SUVs meet the same miles per gallon standard as cars, the pollution that causes global warming, reduce our dependence on foreign oil, and save consumers money at the gas pump. It's a win-win situation for consumers and the environment, and we think that Detroit needs to be moved into the direction so that consumers have more choice when they go to the automobile showroom to buy a car. Right now they can buy an SUV that gets not very good gas mileage, or they can buy an SUV that gets terrible gas mileage. And we think that they should have the choice to be able to buy an SUV that gets good gas mileage.
How do you think last night's victory was accomplished?
Last night's victory was accomplished by the automobile industry putting the squeeze on both their labor contacts and their friends in Congress to keep the status quo in place. It was not a victory for consumers. It was not a victory for the environment. And frankly, we're very disappointed.
What about that alliance? Let me go back to Greg Dana of the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers between the auto industry and big labor, the AFL's support for this whole bill. That's quite an accomplishment.
As it was said earlier on, I think Keith Bratcher said it, the auto industry is a big economic engine in this country. And we have people employed either by the industry directly or in jobs that relate to the industry in all 50 states. And I think everybody in that industry was concerned about these standards because they do have potential for causing severe disruption in the industry in terms of the product we make. And I would say that consumers are the ones choosing these vehicles. And, in fact, consumers are a victor here because they continue to buy the vehicles they want, they need for their uses and purposes. People are buying SUVs because they have a need to carry a large family or to tow a vehicle, to tow a truck, to tow a boat or other things they use. Those vehicles are ideal for that. Most cars today aren't designed, because of their higher fuel efficiency requirements, to tow vehicles very much because they're primarily front-wheel drive, which is good for towing. They don't have that much capacity for a towing weight. So we have to think the consumers are, in fact, choosing what they need for their livelihood and for their needs every day. Even if they don't tow something every day, to be able to tow something once or twice or three times a year, it's important to buy the vehicle that can accomplish that task when it can.
Greg Dana, you say this is what consumers want, but you lobbied fiercely to reject higher fuel efficiency standards. Why not lobby for much more money for higher fuel efficiency research, alternative energy sources, et cetera?
As I said earlier, we have been pushing hard to get provisions in this energy bill that give tax credits for advanced technology vehicles, vehicles that will achieve more miles per gallon, particularly things like hybrids, alternate vehicles, eventually fuel cells, which we think will be a real change in the industry many years out as those vehicles develop. So we have been very, very forcefully, in fact, working on tax credits.
The bill is overwhelmingly weighted toward tax cuts for the energy industry, not for alternative energy.
Well, I'm not interested in those for the bill. We're working on those tax credits for higher fuel efficiency vehicles, advanced technology vehicles, like hybrids. A hybrid is a car with essentially two power systems. It has a regular engine and electric motors and a small battery pack. So there's an inherent additional cost to a hybrid vehicle. And it's cost that we need to overcome in terms of the consumer. And these tax credits, we think, will help get consumers interested in these vehicles so that we can ramp up production of them and, in fact, reduce the cost of them and get those vehicles in the marketplace. And they will achieve much higher efficiency.
Kate Simmons of the Sierra Club, while this is a huge Bush victory, if you go back to October 1997, and Keith Bradshaw wrote about this in the New York Times then, President Clinton announced the position that the U.S. would take in negotiations on the Kyoto Treaty. He conspicuously ignored calls for fuel efficiency restrictions on vehicles like SUVs. How did this happen? It was also 3 weeks after he had a meeting with the big three automakers.
Well, first off, President Bush's energy plan does not address our concerns about global warming. And of course, he has decided to not participate in the Kyoto Warming Treaty. However, I'd like to address an argument that Mr. Dana is making about tax credits. I'd like to point out two things. First of all, Detroit automakers do not have a car on the road right now that is a hybrid, meaning that it combines the electric motor with the gasoline engine. The folks that have the hybrids on the road are Toyota, who actually is a member of the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, and Honda, who is not a member of the Alliance. Now, so in a way, he's speaking for folks that are not at the table. Secondly, with tax credits, for every super efficient hybrid vehicle that gets on the road through these tax credits. The automakers, because CAFE is an average system, as Mr. Dana pointed out, they will be able to put another gas guzzler on the road. Now, Mr. Dana is saying that we need these tax credits to get these vehicles on the road. Right now, the Toyota Prius, you have to wait several months to get one because so many people want them and production levels were not as high as demand was. So, of course, they're going to be making more Priuses, and this is an instance where, yes, the market is working well. However, Detroit is not moving fast enough in the direction of the market. He said that consumers want to have a vehicle choice. However, right now, if you are a mom with a bunch of kids and you wanted a fuel-efficient vehicle to put them in, you would not have a great deal of choice. So this is one instance where the automakers are controlling your choice very tightly. Now, again, Mr. Dana has said that folks want to pull a boat, for instance. Less than 5% of the folks who own SUVs actually use them to pull a boat. What they're actually hauling are lattes home from Starbucks. So let's use the CAFE system, which, as Mr. Dana correctly pointed out, is an average, and put out heavy SUVs for the folks that want them and or need them, and then more efficient SUVs for the folks that would really appreciate them going further on a gallon of gasoline.
I mean, I'm sorry, but, you know, Toyota's putting cars on the road right now, which they're probably not making much money on, if any. They're probably losing money on those. As an attempt to get into the marketplace with something that does make sense, they hope, for the consumer. It's hard to go out and make a production run of hundreds of thousands of vehicles if you can lose money on every one. Toyota is very strongly supporting these tax credits because we need these to push this market forward, and Toyota is a member of the alliance. So I disagree that somehow they aren't at the table. They are a member of this alliance. They've been strongly supporting the tax credits, as have the other companies.
I'd like to bring Keith Bradshaw back into the discussion, Detroit Bureau Chief of the New York Times, whose focus has been maybe obsession for the last 4 years has been the issue of SUVs. Can we go back to this question that I put to Kate Simmons while we're talking about Bush victory right now? If you go back to October 1997, when you were writing extensively about this, Clinton also conspicuously ignored calls for fuel efficiency restrictions on vehicles like SUVs. And also, can you talk about the automakers as well as the unions joining forces and defeating environmentalists?
The automakers and the United Automobile Workers have tremendous influence in Washington because of the size of the industry and the number of people it employs. And that makes it really tough for a Democrat or a Republican to do anything at all about fuel economy. Back in August of 1992, actually, Bill Clinton had a very important meeting. He had been calling during the presidential campaign for much higher fuel economy standards, particularly in a speech on Earth Day of 1992. And George Bush began paying for television ads in August of 92 in Ohio and Michigan saying, if fuel economy standards are raised, then lots of workers are going to be laid off, lots of union workers are going to be laid off in Ohio and Michigan. And the UAW and the leaders of the big automakers met with Clinton in a closed-door meeting August of 92 in Detroit. And he came out of the meeting right here in Detroit and gave a speech saying, well, I don't think I'm in favor of higher fuel economy standards. After all, I'd rather give massive subsidies to the auto industry to pursue exotic technologies that may increase fuel economy. The fact is that Democrats and Republicans alike see the industry as so big and powerful that they're very reluctant to tangle with it. And at a time, even right before Kyoto, President Clinton was very careful to avoid saying that he was going to raise standards. Steve Jokic, the president of the UAW, was also at that meeting in early October of 97, the union has made clear that it does not want an increase in standards. One of the issues here is that the General Motors, Ford, and Daimler Chrysler would have the greatest difficulty in fuel economy standards because they use older technology pushrod engines that are hard to improve in fuel economy. And General Motors, Daimler Chrysler, and Ford are the unionized automakers. So there, it would give an advantage to the non-union foreign-owned automakers that have factories in the American South if you were to raise fuel economy standards, they use a lot more dual overhead cam engines that can have the fuel economy improved. And so the union power in this country has really gone into blocking higher fuel economy standards. The UAW is the nation's wealthiest union, and it is has something like 700,000 active members, 1 million retirees, and several million dependents. It is the 800-pound gorilla of the American labor movement.
I disagree with your technical assessment. There are overhead valve engines across all manufacturers in this industry. What, in fact, is happening is that in the trucks that the big three, GM, Ford, and Daimler Chrysler make, the push-rod engine makes more sense for the type of torque characteristics you want in a truck. Four-valve heads and overhead cam engines are great for lighter-weight vehicles for higher-speed operation, but they're not that good at providing the kind of torque you need for a light-duty truck, and that's why those engines are there.
Yeah, but we are beginning to see an evolution in this regard. The new Chevrolet Trailblazer and GMC Envoy from General Motors are four-valve engines, and I was very surprised to see that. Inline sixes, they raised the fuel economy on those about 2 miles per gallon. I was very impressed, and I went to the General Motors engineers who had worked on that, and they said, well, in fact, we have been using two-valve engines on trucks, but it's really a cost issue. We don't have them. It's too expensive to refit our engine factories to go to four-valve, but if you do to redesign the combustion chamber, for example, in these engines, you can go to a four-valve design and get greater efficiencies. And then if you move to shift to the dual overhead cam designs as well, you can adopt technologies like variable valve timing, which of the sort that were praised by the National Academy of Sciences.
We have to go to a break and end this discussion, but I just want to say in the National Academy of Sciences report, it says that we could save the oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge by simply increasing fuel efficiency standards for SUVs. So there's a very serious connection between SUVs and drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, the bill that was passed last night. It's quite an interesting fact. I want to thank you all for being with us. Our guests have been Greg Dana, who is a spokesperson for the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, Kate Simmons, conservation organizer for the Sierra Club, and Keith Bradshaw, Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times. When we come back, we'll hear a speech by Bill McKibben, well-known environmental writer, on writing, objectivity, protest, and SUVs. Stay with us.
Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me. Oh, things ain't what they used to be now, where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east and far. Whoa, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be now, so now. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be now, so now. Radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live nearby die. Oh, mercy, mercy me.
You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. That music, Mercy, Mercy Me, by Marvin Gaye, as we end today's program with a speech by writer Bill McKibben, who helped to organize a series of protests at car dealerships in the Boston area calling on people to reject SUVs. He is the author of his most recent book, Long Distance, A Year of Living Strenuously, in which he takes a year off from, quote, failing to save the world to train to become a cross-country skier. Also the author of The End of Nature, a landmark work on the threat to the environment posed by our way of life here in the United States. He spoke last weekend at the League of Vermont Writers about social responsibility of writers.
I wanted to talk a little bit today about a subject that's much on my mind, and that's the connection and whether there should be a connection between activism and writing, between the activist and the writer. Now, I was raised as a journalist, a straight journalist. My dad was a newspaper man, finished his career at the Globe. I started working for newspapers when I was 14 or so, working for all the chain of local weeklies where I grew up. Started writing sports stories at 25 cents a column inch, which I'm sure explains my ability to write long. you have to write a lot of column inches in order to really amount to very much at 25 cents an inch. I went off to college. I worked basically, well, I worked a lot more than full-time in the newspaper there. That was all I really did for 4 years of college. I covered city politics. When I was in college, I covered national presidential campaign. I took 3 or so months off to cover the New Hampshire primary. Did an immense amount of that kind of work. And as a reporter, one's trained, socialized, to think of oneself as reporting the story and not playing a part in it, not acting in it. And at some level, that's probably an important and good idea. Less for the, you know, sort of stated goal of being objective, which is an extremely difficult goal, although there are situations in which it's a useful goal too, I think, and in fact, our journalism owes a lot to people who at least make a strong effort toward objectivity. I'm very grateful to the friends of mine who are straight journalists at a lot of places who really make that effort as best they can. But even more important, it's probably the contribution to one's credibility that comes with staying out of stories oneself, with not becoming an activist at the same time. Because rightly or wrongly, activists on issues tend to lose credibility and things. And yet, I've seemed to be drawn inexorably into places where I've eventually felt the need to act. In 1989, I wrote a book called The End of Nature. That was the first book for a general audience about global warming, about climate change, which at the time was very much a controversial hypothesis. It was a successful book. It's now, I think, in 20 languages. It was excerpted in the New Yorker, which is where I'd gone to work when I got out of college, writing Talk of the Town stories at first. It was excerpted in the New Yorker. It was printed around the world. It, you know, was reviewed. It was widely read. And that should have been, at some level, the end of my contribution to this story, you know, or maybe I could have gone on and written other book. And in fact, I have gone on and written other books. But as the decade went on, the last decade went on, I was remarkably impressed by the lack of effect of even a widely read and well-received book in terms of making deep and basic changes in the way that we behave, especially on difficult issues like this. And became more and more convinced as time went on that that one had to follow up on that kind of work if one was truly responsible with trying to engage in the political process some as well. For some years, that mostly meant giving speeches and writing articles for places and people that were doing work, good work. Some of them here in Vermont, some of them places like Wild Earth and things like that, magazines that are really making a difference, doing a lot of work with national environmental groups. But as time went on, even that seemed not substantial enough, partly because this issue, climate change, was being so widely ignored, not only by, I mean, it's very obvious right at the moment that the Bush administration is ignoring it and ignoring it badly, but it also is completely true that it was completely ignored by the Clinton and Gore administration for the last 8 years. And in some ways, much more shamefully, since Al Gore at least knew better than anybody else, any other politician, precisely the stakes in this issue, and yet couldn't bring himself to make the political sacrifices necessary to deal with them. And so I began to get and have begun to get more and more involved in things. They spent much of the last year, I was in Boston on a fellowship at Harvard, but instead of really doing that, I spent much of the year, along with Sophie and some other friends, organizing a series of sport utility vehicle protests that we did, which were a lot of fun. We ended up doing, and it was, we wanted to do it in a good way. We spent a lot of time out on Saturday mornings at automobile dealerships talking with people as they came to buy cars and showing up with hybrid electric so they could drive, test drive them, and think about them. And part of that was, you know, political, and part of it was writing, though of a different kind than I was used to, and discovered again just how important the written word can be. The best of these protests, we managed to draw all sorts of ministers and rabbis and other clergy together. This is one of my interests in the world. I'm a Methodist Sunday school teacher. And we got all sorts of folk together, all these ministers and things. And the day before, we were drawing signs for what we were preparing to sign. People, you know, everyone had signs about, you know, don't waste gas and so on and so forth, none of which seemed to me quite strong enough. So I drew up a sign and convinced one of these ministers to hold it up in his collar. And it just said on it, what would Jesus drive? And predictably, that was enough to get all the TV cameras, all the print journalists, everybody else. That was the one thing that they all noticed and that spread around. And it was reminded me again that there are many types of writing that can be useful. Last year, and there was all sorts of good kinds of writing like that. We did a book this winter, which I contributed a little essay that some friends of mine in Alaska, who are really concerned about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, put together in the course of a month or two after Bush came to power, and it was released on Capitol Hill, filled with little essays from writers about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Last year in Washington, finally feeling really called sort of to do more than I had been, I went with a few friends, including a wonderful New Hampshire native who some of you must know, this woman, Granny D, who marched across the country for campaign finance reform. A great lady. And we went to the rotunda of the Capitol and held up a sign that said, "Stop global warming, stop campaign contributions from global warmers." And it turns out you're not allowed to do that. And we were arrested and taken away. And I was feeling sort of bad in a sense, or sort of nervous about this whole arrest business, because as I say, it's very much unlike my vision of what the role of a writer was and should be, or had been for a long time. But as I was being away, sort of led away in handcuffs, next to me was Granny D, who I think was 92 or something at the time. And she said, "I've never been arrested before either, but I should have started long ago." She said. And it led me all this, and the sort of reflections about all this have led me to think a lot about the nature writers in this country, who in many ways are my My real circle of friends among writers, my literary community, at least nationally, is with the this amazing group of people who I think really are America's great gift to literature. I think our great gift to literature has been the story of our encounter with the natural world. There are other literary traditions that have produced probably greater novels and greater letters and things, but there was no other Western literary tradition that came, that developed while there was still a natural world for people to be in encounter with, you know. In Europe, it had all happened long before, really. And so beginning with, well, even before Thoreau, but beginning most powerfully with Thoreau and passing on through people like John Muir and John Burroughs and Aldo Leopold and Rachel Carson, and on up to the present, when I think our greatest writers are people like the late Ed Abbey and Wendell Berry and Gary Snyder and Terry Tempest Williams and Rick Bass and a whole collection of people like that, doing the most profound, some of the most profound and most beautiful work in this country. And it's a wonderful group, too, because it's positively unliterary in its camaraderie and supportiveness of each other. When I was at The New Yorker, I got to see a lot of different literary worlds, the worlds of the poets and things who were some of the most, at least the ones that were some of the most cutthroat competition I'd ever seen, and things like that. This literary community of nature writers is quite different, incredibly supportive, deep friends, and I think that there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that it's a relatively non-academic tradition, exists relatively outside the academy, and hence people are trained to advance, or not trained to advance by dialectic, by combat of ideas, but rather by, in some ways, the much more human and natural method of kind of synthesis of ideas, looking at other people's work and seeing what's useful in and out of it, which is why Ed Abbey and Wendell Berry, who were as different in many ways as temperaments and in some ways philosophically as could be, were nonetheless each other's greatest champions and extremely able to profit from and work off the other's reflections. More to the point, it's because all the people in those groups, like I am, are working on real things, real issues, real causes, real campaigns. There's a tradition of activism that, of course, runs, it runs back to Thoreau, who was spent the night in jail, as you all know, over the Mexican War, and it runs through John Muir, who started not only created our vocabulary for thinking about wildness and the natural world, but also started the Sierra Club, which became the prototype, not only the prototype environmental group for this country and the world, but in many ways the prototype nonprofit action group of any kind for this country and then for the world, emulated, now in 1,000 places, running through Bob Marshall, who founded the Wilderness Society and was also an amazing writer, running through Rachel Carson, who was, you all know her history probably, was an amazing, was a marine biologist and an amazing writer of the most affectionate and easygoing sort about the oceans. Her books, like The Sea Around Us, are completely lovely and largely apolitical. And then confronted with the evidence of what became Silent Spring, was forced not only to turn her writing in a different direction, but also her life, and to spend the last couple of years of it, even as she was dying, testifying endlessly before Congress and fighting the good fight in all kinds of ways. To people now like Terry Tempest Williams, who I'm sure some of you read, amazing writer, who's done immense amount of work on anti-nuclear testing work in the Southwest, because well, she wrote a book, an essay once called The Clan of the One-Breasted Woman, because virtually every woman in her extended family had come down with cancer, living as they did just downwind of the Big West Range in Utah. To people like Rick Bass, the magnificent writer who's now spent the last 10 years of his life, 15 years of his life in kind of desperate battle to save the huge valley he lives in, the Yaak Valley in Montana, which has been the occasion of some of his great writing. To Richard Nelson, the magnificent Alaska writer who, if you don't know, you should become acquainted with, who's fought the good fight, especially to save the Tongass National Forest. All that work powers their writing. It gives urgency to their writing. It makes it matter deeply in a way that I think at the moment very few literary traditions in this country matter as much as they should. And I guess I'll end just by saying that the one thing that all these people have in common, right back to Thoreau, who said it was a wasted day if he didn't get to walk for 4 hours, was that they, and who in fact walked for 4 hours almost every day of his life, that all of them spent an enormous amount of time in the out-of-doors. Writers, even more than other people, and this is certainly my experience, and certainly describes me, have a great vulnerability to egoism. There you are, having to convince yourself that what it is you're putting down on paper is worth putting down on paper, and people reading, and maybe people paying money to read, and whatever else. And that requires a healthy ego, but it's very easy for that to become an over-healthy ego to the detriment of what it is that we all want to write about and bring out in our work. And at least for me and for the people, the writers I know, the best antidote to that is to spend much more time in forests and on lakes and in mountains, or if you live in the city and in town, in contact with a lot of other people, probably maybe best in service to other people, all to remind oneself that one is not the center of the world. That's an easy trap to fall into as a writer. It's an easy trap to fall into as an American in a consumer society that is intended to convince you that you are the center of the world and the most important thing there could possibly be. But it's a deadly trap in the end for good writing, I think, especially if by good writing you mean what I mean, which is that writing that's likely to produce or hoping to produce some kind of changes in a world that is in need of some kind of changes.
Environmental writer Bill McKibben speaking last weekend at the League of Vermont Writers. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. McKibben's latest book, Long Distance, A Year of Living Strenuously. He also wrote The End of Nature. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by the Brain Trust of Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony Sloan's our engineer and music maestro. Errol Maitland, our technical director. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.